Hello, and welcome to the fifth episode of Crypt Times.
Today on Crypt Times, we'll be listening to Jeff Thomas, a Governor General Award-winning Indigenous photographer, with my friends and your hosts, Kayla and Yusef.
Hello, Jeff, and welcome to Crypt Times. Thank you so much for being here with us.
My pleasure.
I was hoping that you could share with our audience a little bit about who you are and what your practice is.
Okay, well, my name is Jeff Thomas. I was originally from Buffalo, New York. My reserve is over here from the Six Nations of the Grand River. I've been living in Canada now since about 1983. I was in a car accident in 1979, and I couldn't return to the type of work that I'd been doing at the time. So my life changed quite a bit at that point. And I moved to Toronto and started to look at photography as a new way of, or a new, something new for me to do since I couldn't work anymore. And that's where my career actually started, was in Buffalo. And then it became much more focused while living in Toronto. But that's what I've been doing since the late 1970s, developing, it initially began as a response to the representation of Indigenous people through historical photography, and then I used my own work as a kind of a counterpoint to the historical narrative as a contemporary component. So that's been the focus of my new career.
Yeah, that's excellent. And maybe you want to talk a little bit more specifically about how you reach the larger Indigenous community through your work, through the internet and other technologies at this time?
Well, I find that because working with a disability, it's been very advantageous to me to have new technology to be able to continue to be active and to reach an audience. And I think also too, to build a larger audience in the Indigenous arts community, there's been a large focus on developing your voice, finding your voice in the various mediums, and also, having a foothold in museums and art galleries and art institutions and that. And we've done very well at that. And my feeling now is that the time is to focus our work on reaching our own communities, young people who especially could benefit from the work that we do, and to find a way to, encourage Indigenous young people, because coming from the era of the residential school, education has been a negative word. And how do we begin to change that around? And I think there's a real strong sense that we are connected to the visual arts as a people in terms of expression in that. And so I found that using photography was a way to bridge that gap and to begin finding what it is that we want to say through photographs. But new technology, in fact, has brought around me to my current program of work of using it to, build on my role as a storyteller. I've been working in photography for a long time, but it never felt comfortable, in terms of the art gallery space, the kind of staid space of the museum. And how do we begin, because it's not Indigenous, and how do we begin to address that? So that's been the focus of my work all along, but more when new technology came about, it offered me tools that I hadn't had before. And that's what I'm currently developing in my work.
Are there any of those tools in particular that you found to be very successful in reaching young people? It seems to be some that like community seems to be such a big part of what you do. Have there been any of those tools that you found particularly effective or that you thought would be effective and turned out to be, not so much?
No, not really, because I've really developed my practice with patience and thinking and moving along reasonable kind of speed and not getting too far ahead of myself. And I found that, you know, with new technology and that, it just, I began thinking about my practice in a different way at that point, expanding on it. But I think that probably the best example, I haven't had any negative responses, especially with the work that I do as a curator with historical photographs, because in 2001, I developed a residential school exhibition, Where Are the Children? And it opened here in Ottawa on National Aboriginal Day in 2002. And at that time, there was a lot of kind of hesitation as to whether or not you could take photographs that had been produced as propaganda for the residential schools and turn them around and begin using them as a way of revitalization and seeing ourselves. And so there was a bit of criticism before that because people just thought, you know, you can't do that. But it turned out that the exhibition has been traveling across Canada to this day. So from 2002 to now, it's been on the road, and it proved to be very effective in terms of the stories that the community is able to tell through the photographs. So the photograph itself became a catalyst. There's no right or wrong about it. It's just a place and time, and how do you add your story to that image? So I think that in terms of that, it's been very effective in my own work, my personal work. I've been looking at developing a new body work called Where the Rivers Meet. And it's really determined by my real desire that I had when I began to work in photography to find something, a format that's indigenous. And so with this new body of work, that's what I've been doing is using like the wampum belt format, that's traditional way of capturing history in Iroquois culture, and utilizing that as a format and then playing around with the images that I use, juxtaposing historical and contemporary. But the idea behind the work is really to get people thinking and the kind of the clash of two disparate kind of images, what comes out of that. And so that's what really intrigues me. You know, it's not about, I guess, reading the photographs in a particular way, but really finding your own voice. Because when I was growing up and listening to storytellers in my family, it was always interesting because there was always a certain point where during listening to their stories that you would find yourself drifting off and kind of inserting your own feelings or impressions into the story. And then you come back and it's like you didn't miss a step along the way. And I always thought that was something that was very remarkable about indigenous storytelling, is that you find your own level within that. And that's what I've been trying to do with my own work. I think now that I've started working and really referring to myself as a photo-based storyteller, mm-hmm. Is to build on that idea. So how does the story manifest itself today? So as a part of the Wampum Belt series, Wampum Belts traditionally had been told orally by the keeper of the Wampum Belts. And I wanted to apply that as well to my work. And so I'm developing stories that go along with each one. I'm going to record them. And then I'm working on a new website now that will have all of that information on their own, you know, all the research material, the story behind each belt, and also using 3D scanning as a part of it as well.
Wow.
So that's been the most interesting part, because I found that working as a disabled person, as an artist, that there's only so much that I can do. And especially now at this stage of my life. And so I'm working with a technician who is able to go out and to actually scan different monuments. In Toronto, he did the Hockey Hall of Fame. And above, that used to be a Bank of Montreal. And above the Hockey Hall of Fame is a crest that usually has two Indian men on it. But this one, the date is 1885 on it, and it has a woman on one side. And I've never seen that before. So my technician was able to go there and use a drone and 3D scan the facade along with the crest. And it's just amazing of what it does. So how do you create a story from a 3D scan? Looking at the material that he shot so far, it looks like a dream. You know, it has that kind of feel of disjointedness from the reality that we're used to. And I just love that feeling of that, of letting the mind kind of soar in that area. So it's currently in the process of, okay, so what stories are we going to write to go along and incorporate this into the work? And then, of course, you know, it can be incorporated into a website and reach a larger audience, coming back to your question as well. And I think in using 3D technology and things like that, and drone, is that it's going to capture a younger audience, which is what I've been wanting to find a way to do to make it interesting and challenging. So, yeah.
That's amazing. Do you have a projected date for when that's available online, or is some of it available now? Or,
well, the new website should be going up probably early next year.
Okay.
And the title of it is just simply wherethe rivers meet.ca. I'm not sure when we're going to launch it yet, but there's still a lot of work to do, but that's the idea. And it's going to work in conjunction with Bodies in Translation. They're the ones that have funded the technological part of it. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to incorporate it into an exhibition as well, so it'll have a wider audience in terms of who we want to reach in that. So
right.
That's,
oh, that's so exciting. I can't wait to see it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I wanted to chat for a minute about your relationship to Bodies in Translation and your relationship to disability art, if that's okay. When we spoke before, you said you never really addressed your disability until you worked with Bodies in Translation. And it was the first time you had heard an elder Mona Stonefish, talk about disabilities. And that really informed your work and your identity in new ways. So maybe you want to talk about, you know, limitations and challenges, but also new ways of working and modifying in a disability aesthetic way blended with your Indigenous art.
Well, the way that it all began was, as I mentioned before, after my car accident, I had to find something that I could do with my life that I could physically handle. And that's how I fell into photography. But in the beginning, it was more of a way of getting myself out of the house. So I'd go for a walk as part of my rehabilitation. And each day I would go out a little bit farther, and I decided that I'd take my camera with me and started making photographs along the way. And it just continued from there. And my focus at that time was really on the, I guess, just the regular everyday landscape of Buffalo, New York. It wasn't anything strategic in terms of addressing indigeneity and living in the city, urban reserve, and all that. That would come later. But at the time, I had to make a decision over a period of time as to whether or not I would continue to go through with rehabilitation and things like that. I had pretty much exhausted everything that I could reasonably do, but I had to make a decision that I would pursue my work over everything else, because I only had enough energy to do one thing. I couldn't go through rehab or continue doing that and also the dream that I had in the arts. So that's the decision that I made. And from that point on, my real objective was to prove to people that an Indigenous person with a disability could reinvent their life and become successful from it. I wanted that role to take on and to prove that. Because when I had my car accident and I was in a hospital in Southern Ontario, the doctors they kept on questioning me, thought I was drinking, that I had, you know, passed out at the steering wheel and hit a telephone pole. And it didn't seem like anybody really believed me, that I wasn't on drugs or something, but I wasn't. And it just set in my mind that I have to prove to all these people that they're all wrong, and that I couldn't really get a career started after what I had gone through. So that was the objective. And I just went ahead and just, I guess, started teaching myself all the things I needed to know and pursued, you know, developing a career. And to my surprise, it developed into a career, which I didn't expect. I hoped it would, but I really didn't expect it to. And And I guess that my feeling was never to kind of dismiss my disability, but to be able to not let it hold me back and to not kind of think about it all the time. So it's kind of a mind thing that, you know, you're playing with on yourself. It's like, how do you get into a state of mind where you still deal with the pain and the disability, but you still pursue this? So it all worked out in that sense. And it really is, as you mentioned, Mona Stonefish, it wasn't until I went to the first meeting for Bodies in Translation that I began to get a different sense of my disability coming back into focus and realizing that, boy, you know, it's time to start making it the focus of my work. And I had never been anywhere before where there was an elder that talked about Indigenous people with disabilities. It just, you know, and I think that was part of why I was able to work so well over the years, is because there just wasn't any kind of conversation about it. You know, and there was no conversation about Indigenous photography. Mm-hmm. So I guess the challenge really worked out well for me because it cleared everything else out, and that's all that I did. But now it's, I guess the way that I look at it now is that everything comes at its proper time. And actually it was a friend of mine, Anna Hudson, who works as a professor at York University, had suggested to Bodies in Translation for a possible project. And that's how it started. At that point, I would say that this was 3 years ago that the conversation started. And then Bodies in Translation accepted our proposal. And I had to really start thinking about, how do I incorporate new technology into the stories I want to tell? I had no idea. So it took a couple of years just of constantly thinking about it and thinking, how am I going to accomplish this? And so it began to work out. And now it's, I'm finding that it's very effective because losing more mobility as I get older, it seems to correspond with what's happening now. And I don't have to travel in order to, like what we're doing now, have a conversation in person. We can do it, you know, through the internet, which is great. So it's been really interesting for me to experience a way to continue working with my disability and to even broaden it farther than I would have without the technology. So it's been pretty amazing.
It certainly seems like it. What really strikes me about all that you've just said is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it doesn't seem like you had your cultural touchstones growing up and your relation and like the relationship to storytelling and all these different things that have like sort of shaped you as to who you are. Yet you've gone on this journey to become this, you know, fantastic photographer, storyteller, artist. And I was just wondering, what would you pass on to our younger artists who are like who look like yourself? What would you have wanted at that age? Mm-hmm. When you were starting out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been an interesting question because it's one that it's really kind of directed my more recent work. And I was, you know, growing up, I was very fortunate to have my grandmother, my great aunt in my life who were my mentors and elders and provided me with a direction and a work ethic that I used. I didn't have male role models. My father was an absentee father. My grandfathers I didn't know one grandfather, and one had passed away just before I was born. And, you know, there was no one around, no intellectual base that I could talk to in terms of photography and what it means to Indigenous people. These were questions that I tried to address when I was even in high school. And even along with the urbanization challenge of how do you identify as Indigenous and living in a city, and is there a difference between urban and reserve Indigenous people? What is it, and how does it make us think differently about ourselves? So there were a lot of questions that, you know, came into mind and in play in the beginning of my practice. I realized at a certain point that nobody was going to come along and, you know, like what I call the super elder, the person that had all the answers, you know, that could put into context residential schools, colonialism, along with urbanization and photography and representation. And, you know, I realized that, nope, it's not going to happen. You have to do it yourself. Mm-hmm. And so that was my working premise for my work. And how was I going to accomplish that? And I found that it was interesting because dealing with these issues, I realized that with my elders that they couldn't, we would have conversations, but those conversations, I realized that they were all directed towards me in terms of I had to find the answers to my own questions. And that's what I decided that I was going to do. And in terms of, I think my curiosity about the world is what really has driven me in terms of wanting to get out and to see and to understand. And how do you find a balance with your identity in an urban setting? And that led to my work with public monuments and using those as kind of waypoints on this new map that I was developing. And what is the importance of a public monument in terms of my work with Indigenous representation or kind of stereotyping on a monument? It gives you a place to talk, to focus on, to photograph, and so developing conversation. So in my mind, during all this period of time, I was having these conversations, not with a real person, but with myself in my head. And so I think that when I look back now, and I wouldn't want to change anything, because I love the way that it forced me to think and to learn and to look at issues and find an alternative to it, or a way of, let's say, of bridging historical photographs to the contemporary world. What is the value of those photographs, and how do we create a new voice along the way? And I realized that in my mind that historical photographs were latent in terms of like a negative, a black and white negative. And so you have this latent image on, you know, and how do you develop it? You make decisions about what you want to do in terms of developing it, printing, and then context. Mm-hmm. So looking at historical photographs in that way was the same and just worked out a bit differently. But nobody could have taught me these things. So I had to learn as I went along. And I also made a deliberate decision when I was in university, they had a photography program, and I decided not to go into it because I didn't want anybody kind of changing my direction. I wanted it to stay as pure as possible because I knew that what I was looking for didn't exist yet. And even my mentor in Buffalo, Milton Rickoven, was a well-known documentary photographer. And when he looked at my work, he looked at my powwow photographs on my second visit, and he was kind of, he wasn't that happy with the first work that I showed, as happy as with the first work that I showed him, which was my urban studies. And he thought that, well, you know, isn't there something you could be doing that's more beneficial to your community than photographing powwow dancers? And I couldn't answer him at the time. This was about 1981. And now I wish I could go back and talk to him and tell him exactly why that was important, because now I understand it. But it's the pursuit of wanting to understand. It's the pursuit of realizing that our cultures have never been static. They've always been in flux. And so why not at this point? We have traditions we have that are being carried on. We still have Indigenous languages that are around. But what I see is that I want to know, where do we go from here? How do we build on that? And is there room for a new kind of language? Is there room for a new type of ritual and ceremony that revolves around the arts? Mm-hmm. That's what intrigues me. And that's what I'm looking for. So that's my advice to anybody that, you know, when I look back, I wish I knew these things back then, but of course, that's not the idea. It's, you know, you don't want to see into the future, because if you do that, then what's the point of living? It's, you know, everything already, right? So it's the unknown that is really, really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really love that you knew even those many years ago that, you know, formal photography education wasn't the way forward for you. And obviously that's worked out in many ways. Maybe you want to share with our listeners or readers about how you use miniature figurines in your work, and you've used miniature figurines before to start some of those conversations. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, sure. That's my series called Indians on Tour. Mm-hmm. And it really began when I came to Ottawa for the first time in 1992 to see the Samuel de Champlain monument. And a friend had told me that there's a lot, you know, full-size Indian figure kneeling at the base of the monument. So we came up to Ottawa and checked it out. And it was interesting because I waited for all the tourists and that to kind of leave. And then I went up to the Indian figure. And for some reason, I felt motivated to talk to him. Like, I would treat him like I was going to photograph, like a living person. And the last thing that I asked him, I said, where would you go if you could leave this place? And it set off all kinds of questions about what would a 16th century indigenous person, how would they respond to the 21st century? And it's like, in one way, we're still dealing with the same issues that he would have to have dealt with moving into a city and that, and the same kind of political stuff going on. And so when he was finally removed in 1999, there was a protest by the Assembly of First Nations in 1996, and they threw a blanket over the Indian figure and cited reasons for his removal. And it's really interesting now to look at how this predated what's going on in the U.S. with Civil War monuments. Mm-hmm. And but at that time, they went into conversations with the National Capital Commission and decided that they would remove the Indian figure. And when they finally did it in 1999, he was moved just across the street from the Champlain Monument. And I felt obligated to begin looking at where would he go now. And it just happened that my friend Ali Kazmi, who made a film about my work called Shooting Indians, A Journey with Jeff Thomas, he introduces the film with a plastic cowboy and a plastic Indian to kind of set up what the direction of the film. So at this time, he sent me a box that had the figures inside of it with a little note that said, you'll probably find something interesting to do with these. So I took one out with me and walked around Ottawa and found a place and put him next to the statue with an Indian hunter in the background and photographed it. And that was the first one in 2000 that I made using one of those plastic Indian figures. And from that point on, it began to evolve into a larger project that I started taking these figures with me wherever I traveled. So if I went to Switzerland or Paris or London, if I went anywhere in the US or in Canada, I would take them with me and photograph them in different locations. And the idea behind the title for Indians on Tour was a reference to the Buffalo Bill Wild West shows in the late 19th century, when he had a cast of Lakota Sioux people that he would take as performers. And they traveled all over the world. And I had seen photographs where they were photographed like in a gondola in Venice and things. And I thought, yeah, this is how I want my plastic Indians to look as well. Calling into question removal, absence of indigenous people from these particular spaces. Where have they gone now was another title that I worked with. Kind of referencing the tourists that would come and want to see authentic Indians. And it also kind of in a way repopulated the landscape, because we lived everywhere before Europeans arrived. And so who knows how much activity was going on where I live in Ottawa. But I wanted to say with those figures that we have been to all of these places. I had an exhibition, I've had several exhibitions with them. And one time somebody came up to me and said, you know, I looked at the images and I didn't know whether to cry or laugh. And I said, that's perfect, because you can do both. And that's how I feel when I make those photographs. But it's a form of empowerment as well. It's because there's so little for me to photograph that is Indigenous related. There are only so many Bank of Montreal, so many statues, so many monuments that can be photographed that have Indigenous content. This gave me a way to play with that presence. So when people look at them, I want them to be aware that an Indigenous person is photographing these figures in these particular places. What does that say? And so it's really not about having the answers, but it's just about positioning a question that people can, if they want to, begin to find out more about. And with that in mind as well, the use of a website is a way for people that want to know more can actually go to my website and find out the history behind different locations and things like that. So over time, I also began to expand, and I would find new figurines that I would begin to use, and some that are larger and more elaborate than that. So there's a whole cast of figures that I've used over since 2000. So it's turned into, I think, probably one of my favorite series that I do, just simply because it's so much fun to do and finding places. And then to watch people's reaction when they see you put, you know, this Indian figure on a tripod and then photograph it. And it's just like, what's going on here? But that's the thing that I love about it, is being able to do that. So just to say that these are all still works in progress, but that's the idea, is that at some point, where's the apex for all of this work? And I don't know yet, but it's coming soon. It has to. I've been doing it for so long, you know, it's like at some point you want to just relax and move on, but it's just so compelling that, you know, it's hard to give it up, so.
That's fantastic, and we'll definitely link to your website in our show notes so that everyone can.
Us and the listeners are definitely going to be keeping an eye out for the apex whenever that happens.
yeah. Well, I'm working on an exhibition for here in Ottawa at the Ottawa Art Gallery, and I think it's 2022. And so I'm hoping that at that point, that's when it'll take place, that everything that I've been working on will finally kind of coalesce and come into focus as one major statement about what I've been in pursuit of. So yeah, so hopefully it won't be too much longer.
Fantastic. I'll be sure to come down to Ottawa for that. I'm hoping by that time, you know, we'll all be able to travel safely.
Hopefully.
And experience the world and each other in person again.
Or I wanted to ask you, Jeff, if there's anything we haven't got to yet that feels important for you to share in this space that is on your mind or your heart that you wanted to share.
Well, I was one time I gave a keynote address, and it was on reconciliation. They wanted me to talk about exactly that, and at that time, I was thinking about, well, what does it really mean in terms of Indigenous people? And it's not us that have to reconcile colonialism and that. But what I think what I've always felt is that it's how do we begin to do it ourselves within our own families? And my focus began in Toronto on Queen Street in 1984 when I photographed my then 7-year-old son Bear on Queen Street in front of a tag on the wall that said Cultural Revolution. And that photograph set in motion, it began with just with the idea that I saw it as kind of a ritual in a way of my father-son relationship and having my son involved in what I do, because I was never like that with my own father. And it was a way of, it really was a way for me to continue to keep working and thinking that I'm doing this for my son and empowering him, along with and his mother, who is an actress, Monique Mojica in Toronto. We've both given him that sense of empowerment that we found over the years within our own lives. And what I really believe that his success is a result of that, of being bear witness of a Tribe Called Red and the success that he's had with that. And it's just been a wonderful experience to see my son grow in that way. And I think, you know, really that's the bottom line for me in my what I do and the message that I want to convey is that how do we treat our children? And it's not always easy. You know, it hasn't been easy for me to do it. I've had to overcome things that I've acquired from generations of negative behavior in our family and that, but it's possible. And I think that's the message that I really want to convey with my work. Of course, I've overcome my disability and different things along the way, but I think at the bottom line, it's having a son and being responsible for him is how does he become a part of this process as well? And so what I know, even if my career ended today, that what I wanted to be able to do is carry on in my son. And he's doing that. And he's doing it for the right reasons as well, which I find is so important. And that's, I think really that's the message that I want to leave people with. Mm-hmm.
Mm. Thank you. That's beautiful. Yeah, it's really lovely note to wind down on. As Youssef was saying, we always end with the same two questions with our guests on this show. So first I would ask you, just because as you mentioned, we are recording remotely over Zoom, we're still in this pandemic. So what has your life looked like during COVID-19 times, if at all different or?
That's a good question because I found that when I'm asked that, I usually say that I didn't even notice it. And primarily because I'm a hermit by nature. And I've needed to sit down and just work and go through everything that I've been able to produce over all of these decades. And then what does it all mean? And I've been able to clean up, you know, my computer in that sense of going and doing the things that I could never had the time to do before. And of course, you know, with the Zoom and that and Facebook and things, you can still stay in touch with people. I've gotten comfortable being on Zoom and, and it's worked out well. So no, it's a terrible situation that we're in, and that, you know, I know that there are people out there that have to deal with, you know, really bad issues in terms of sending their kids to school and this and that. But, you know, I've been fortunate in terms of being self-employed and working at home that I just turned it into something that's been more of a positive in terms of, yeah, now I can get some work done.
That's great. And there's been lots of access elements that have come out of this new world we find ourselves in, for sure, as you mentioned. And lastly, Jeff, I would ask you, what is bringing you joy right now, lately?
That's a good question. I've never really thought about something like that before. I think it's really about how things, you know, there's certain, you know, in our lives, everything seems to come together and you can't make that happen. It's for me, and I think coming back to bodies and translation and this, the joy has really been finding how it is to work with other people. Like I have a coordinator now that I could afford to hire for this project. I have a technician that I can work with. And I'm looking forward to winter in the sense that we'll be figuring out how to develop a storyline and go on and use video and different things and what we're going to do next with this project. And I think that for me, that's what I've been finding. It's you, if you stick around long enough, everything falls into place. And it seems like that's what's happening right now. There's just so many things that that can be done and used and new technologies and that I find that there's a certain amount of joy that goes into that because the work is my life. And now I guess I figured out a lot of things at this point, and it's just going into the work and it's starting to make sense. So it's not like you're writing something and wish I knew to write. I can't write anything, but now I sit down and I start writing, and there's something to write about. And that's something that my elder had said to me when I was a teenager, because I used to sit around at the table when they would have visitors come over and listen to the elders talk and their stories. And then one time my elder said that someday Jeff is going to tell his own story, not our story. So it kind of was burnt in my mind as a mantra. And what is my story? And why won't I be telling their story? It's because generations have new responsibilities. And I feel that I'm fulfilling mine. You know, I made a vow when I was a young boy that at some point that I would be able to do that. And I would come back and I would show my elders what I had done. Of course, I can't do that because they're no longer here, but it doesn't matter, because it stays in your mind and you continue to use it even if they're not no longer here in a physical sense. And there's a lot of joy in all of that. So yeah, it's worked out.
Crypt Times is presented as a part of the Wheels on the Ground podcast network. This podcast is produced by us and supported by Tangled Art Plus Disability and Bodies in Translation. If you enjoyed this interview, we release new episodes every Monday wherever good podcasts can be found.
Hey, we're J+J+J, and I bet you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
The sitar.
We call it that. Do you?
You should. Unless you don't like sitar.
Hi, I'm Karan Saxena, and you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM broadcasting from the unceded land of the Musqueam people from UBC's Point Grey campus in Vancouver. This is Forgotten British Columbia, a series on the history of the province that has been erased and those that have been forgotten. Today, we're going to talk about Hogan's Alley. A brief content warning, this episode contends with the displacement of Black communities in Vancouver, institutionalized anti-Black racism, and police brutality. So for those who might find it distressing, you might want to come back to 101.9 in a few minutes. Others, we encourage you to listen. There has been a Black community in Vancouver since before there was a Vancouver, said Wade Compton, a Vancouver-born writer who co-founded the Hogan's Alley Memorial Project in 2006. Hogan's Alley was the neighborhood of the downtown east side by Strathcona that was home for many immigrants, but mostly Black people. A Black community had established itself at the T-shaped intersection, being so close to the Great Northern Railway Station, employing many Black men as porters. This was a thriving community of working-class Black Canadians, which then fell prey to urban rezoning for the Georgia Viaduct Replacement Project in the 60s. Being the subject of debate about its status as a slum since 1929, the city of Vancouver did not deem Hogan's Alley as a residential area.
Hogan's Alley was a T-shaped alley. The north-south part ran parallel to Main Street, and then it T'd right where the Georgia Viaduct is. So from Main all the way to Jackson Avenue, between Union Street on the north side and Pryor on the south. Hogan's Alley was not a Black-only neighborhood at all. It was where Italians in Vancouver traced their origins to as well, and it was right on the edge of Chinatown. But it did have a cluster of Black businesses and institutions in the church that were significant to the Black community and some residential areas.
When a working-class immigrant space like Hogan's Alley was regarded as a place mired with social ills, people had different ways of dealing with it. For Hogan's Alley, it was urban reform.
Vancouver has accepted the challenge, knowing that to build a better city requires only the industry and ingenuity of man.
Urban reform started to decimate communities across North America in the 60s and 70s, specifically poor and communities of color, under the guise of improving city life. Neighborhoods like Hogan's Alley started being talked about as diseases, often using the terms mold and blight to refer to them.
Most of Vancouver is kept strong and healthy through the normal process of land and building renewal. But in areas such as this, nothing happens except dilapidation and decay gets worse each year. Property values fall, and blight is the result.
All questions about the Georgia Viaduct project were hidden from the public. A social planner from UBC, Leonard C. Marsh, recommended in a proposal to the city that the Strathcona district, including Hogan's Alley, which Marsh called a slum, be completely destroyed and redeveloped. North American obsession around car culture began to force freeways. But of course, the freeways would not dare be built close to powerful neighborhoods. Cities began enacting urban reform with slum clearance in black communities and Chinatowns, both of which were under attack in Vancouver. Before the city began expropriations, most of the black families had left the area. After the viaduct projects had wiped out most of Hogan's Alley by 1967, community opposition stopped the remaining parts of the plan, saving Chinatown. For black Canadians, Hogan's Alley was more than a neighborhood. It was their community, a place where they found home when the rest of the city was unwelcoming towards them. In fact, the first black church in Vancouver was founded by Nora Hendrix, the grandmother of the famous musician Jimi Hendrix. Black churches, juke joints, famous businesses like Buy's Chicken and Steakhouse, and the Pullman Porters Club, all demolished for an elevated highway. In a CBC interview in June 2020, Stephanie Allen, the co-founding board member of the Hogan's Alley Society, said that black Canadians did not find community again like they did in Hogan's Alley. This was out of fear of being displaced again, out of fear that they would be over-policed and racially targeted, which Allen called survival mechanism. Hogan's Alley Society says that city councillors should understand the importance of a cultural enclave that black Canadians need and how these spaces are not meant for private profit. That the city should commit to a community land trust and not just make hollow statements on anti-black racism after the killings of DeAndre Campbell, Regis Korchinski-Paquette, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, and Ahmaud Arbery. For Allen, a community land trust would mean 70% below market rent and 30% market rent with no private ownership. She says that this is merely to ensure housing for people to have joys in their lives, all the while addressing homelessness, racism, the unjust criminalization of poverty, and over-policing of black people.
A community land trust is a way to put the community members in control a little bit of their destiny, to have a say, and to really prevent that kind of gentrification or displacement that has impacted so many lower income and black communities.
Canada might have seen a significant shift in its zoning schemes, but the policies still target immigrants, refugees, and low-income folks. Zoning projects like the one demolishing Hogan's Alley punish the working class by limiting their ability to find affordable housing, let alone home ownership in the real estate fiasco of Canada. You'd think that we've come to a point where housing would be regarded as a human right, but that's still a far-fetched utopian concept, or so they say. Meanwhile, the aftermath of such atrocities will be ongoing, through the loss of culture, community, safety, solidarity, and a place to call home. As advocates and activists continue to fight for reparations for those that were harmed by such systemically racist policies, which were meant to displace and dispossess people, we should continue to counter the narrative that Canada has ever been better than other countries that were built upon genocide, especially when it comes to the settler colonial governance structures of Canada. Such a thought process is dangerous and revisionist in nature, and only ensures a pathway for history to repeat itself, something that advocates like Wade Compton have actively tried to combat. Today's episode was written and edited by me, Karan Saxena. It was co-produced by Hannah Imam and Karan Saxena. The music for Forgotten British Columbia is produced by Cronfused. You can also listen to the show online by visiting citr.ca and looking up Forgotten British Columbia. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you.
Some 30 solo nights where alone and high tides take turns as she pulls, hanging on beyond the sky. And I'm trying. Can you see?
To wake you.